Good morning, everybody. We're back again with Solomon on Blast, and I've caught up putting the last few shows on the website, solomononblast.com. So if you've missed a show or you want to share one with somebody, they're all there. And I want to say a happy Mother's Day to my mother out there. Hopefully she's listening. Usually she is. And so a reminder that tomorrow is Mother's Day. Hopefully that reminder is unnecessary for most people. But if you weren't aware of it, you still have time to plan something special for your mother, grandmother, or whoever it is that you consider that significant mother figure in your life. And our mothers should be significant in our lives. But my question is, are they in today's culture? If so, just how significant? Well, if we only look at it from a monetary aspect, you might think so. According to my favorite statistics website, statisticsbrain.com, there are 84.5 million moms in the U.S., and we spend about $671 million on Mother's Day cards alone, $1.9 billion on flowers. Obviously, the florists think Mother's Day is significant. The total amount spent for mothers on Mother's Day in the U.S., $20.7 billion. It's a lot of money spent on what's considered honoring our mothers. That's good. And we know the fifth commandment tells us to honor our father and mother, that our days may be long upon the land. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing in terms of going out there and buying the cards and the flowers, but a card and some flowers one day a year really isn't honoring our mothers, to some extent maybe, but overall, not really. At least it's a starting point, especially if somebody hasn't been wise enough to have been honoring their mother in the past. In our culture today, though, even with the amount of money spent for mothers on Mother's Day, there still seems to be a lot of people that aren't honoring their mother the way the Bible says. Why do I say that? Because our culture consists of people that do a lot of foolish things. And I'm sure you don't really need proof, but if you do, just look at YouTube. Why else would there be videos that go viral with some of the most ridiculous and stupidest things you can imagine? Something that used to be an embarrassment that you'd never want your mother to know about is now purposely put on YouTube in the hopes that it goes viral. Just consider Dakota Johnson, the one that the actress in the 50 Shades of Grey, in an interview, she said she didn't want her mom and dad to check out her acting talents, but she still did the movie, so it wasn't enough to stop her from doing the movie. So whatever it did happen to being afraid of, you know, your mother finding out things. Nobody seems to be concerned about the consequences anymore. And maybe it's because in the post-Christian culture we live in, people don't have the wisdom necessary to understand the consequences. But Solomon's wisdom tells us the truth. Proverbs 10:1, he says, "A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the grief of his mother." And then in Proverbs 15:20, he says, "A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish man despises his mother." And Proverbs 29:15, "The rod and the rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother." What is Solomon saying? He's saying the foolishness of a child really ends up hurting their mother. The moms are affected much more by the foolishness than the fathers are. The father, in all those verses, responds positively to the wise child, but it's always the mother that's negatively affected by the foolish one. Maybe because we fathers don't get as emotional about things, but the sad part is that single-parent families have more than tripled as a share of our American households since 1960, and most of those single-parent families are led by mothers. And in that environment, there's no father to handle the foolish child, so the mom suffers the brunt of the foolish behavior. That's not honoring your mother. That's why I think no matter how much money is spent on Mother's Day, we live in a culture that is more and more, isn't it really into honoring the mother? Solomon's wisdom knew that would be the case, and he points it out in Proverbs 30:11. "There is a generation that curses its father and does not bless its mother. It may not be this generation entirely, but unless things change, that generation that curses its father and does not bless its mother isn't very far away." But things can change. With Solomon's wisdom, we can combat this confused culture. That's our hope, our plan anyways. at least after this commercial break. We'll be right back with more Solomon on Blast.
Want to keep tabs on your favorite Power Talk hosts and Fox Sports Radio? Start at the website, powertalk1210.com. There you can stream the shows, listen to past interviews on SoundCloud, see our latest tweets, and generally get sick and tired of us all. It's the perfect way to stay close with your Power Talk family. Power Talk 1210. Check it out.
Does it seem like your car is driving you around in circles? It probably is if you've been driving Tucson City streets and your car is out of alignment. If it is, then it's costing you money. Your tires wear out faster and you're spending more on...
We're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Pat Benatar says, hit her with your best shot. Well, I'm wondering if maybe Pamela Geller's thinking the same thing. Go ahead and hit me with your best shot. This past week, with all of the attack that attempted to occur with the event that they were holding in Garland, Texas, I wonder if she's thinking that. Proverbs 10:20 says, the tongue of the righteous is choice silver, but the heart of the wicked is worth little. And I think in this particular case, Pamela Geller's got the right kind of choice going on there with regards to what she thinks is necessary to maybe expose what's going on with the ISIS and the people here in the States. Now, this particular article says that she pledges another free speech event despite all of the mounting criticism that's going on. She's on a mission for sure, it says, but the nature, objectives, and end game for her quest are among the most contentious topics in the America's present debates regarding self-expression and hate speech. So is it hate speech?
Well, I think the fairest question here, Doug, and this is a fair question, is this. Is Pamela Geller shouting fire in a crowded theater? Is she staging events? This is the question. Is she staging events that could bring danger to the general public? And I think you have to ask that question in order to try to get a handle on what is going on. And so I think we have to analyze that question in order to kind of understand whether or not this is really about free speech. So I'm thinking about this. I have some thoughts here. Just kind of looking into the origin of that statement, I found out one of the reasons why they were so concerned about the theater, the crowded theater, was because back in the day, celluloid was used for film and it was extremely flammable, especially in a situation where you didn't have all of these resources to put out fires. That would have been a very serious concern to any group of people in a theater with a very hot machine and celluloid passing through the light.
Right.
Second one is that these theaters have limited exits, and so that should keep you very concerned that someone doesn't shout fire. And the third thing is basically it was the whole idea of calming public fears that everything's going to be okay in order for them not to panic. Because if anybody said fire in a situation where you could be trapped in a building, then
people
would panic and cause all kinds of havoc. So I think analyzing it from that point of view is very important, because is this what Pamela Geller is doing? And as you look at, you know, really try to compare it to the spirit of all of that, I'd have to say this is not what's happening at all. In fact, I think in some ways she's a bit of a Paul Revere here.
And I would say the media is more along the lines of the ones yelling fire in the crowded theater, because they have a tendency to over exaggerate and blow things way out of proportion. And if you don't have the panic out there, then you don't have news stories to sell.
Absolutely. That's an interesting reversal. But basically, you know, Pamela Geller's been doing this for 10 years. See, because the media's reporting it now, and we heard about this.
This one episode.
This particular episode, we have the impression that she just got on a soapbox all of a sudden.
Only because Charlie Hebdo was going to try and get some publicity. Yeah,
publicity for her thing. But that's not what's been happening at all.
We have David waiting on the line. I want to hear what David has to say. Good morning, David. Welcome to Solomon.
Oh, yeah, hi. Have you all ever seen, you remember, you know, a month or so ago, they had the shooting in Paris, and that was that cartoon,
right.
The magazine called Charlie Hebdo. Charlie Hebdo, right.
Right, and that's
have
what she was kind of.
Have you all ever actually seen those cartoons?
Oh, yeah, they're not really targeted at any specific group. They're pretty much across the board. They're
right, but very but in other words, the ones that actually had Muhammad in them. Because, see, to me, what the discussion is whether or not there's some respect or whether or not it's more like white trash. And, in other words, if you look at Charlie Hebdo, the last cartoon before the shooting has Muhammad on his knees and ISIS is up behind him trying to cut his head off. So what to me that means is this phony group, ISIS, who claim they're Mohammedans, they're actually killing Muhammad. And that's a very political statement, and it's very respectful to Islam because it shows the phoniness of ISIS. And in fact, if you look at the origins of ISIS, you realize that they're really nothing more than a pack of cutthroats that are hired by the oil and gas companies to kick people off their land and steal their mineral rights. So ISIS is, you know, that's why they wear face masks, because you don't know if they're, you know, a pack of hitmen from around the world that are pretending to be Muslims, but in fact they're just hitmen. And so then when you get into Pamela Geller, I'm looking at her website, and almost every one of her the artwork with Muhammad on them are really just white trash crap. And so that they have nothing, no political aspect to them. They're just white trash.
Well, David, let me just say this. Pamela Geller's angle is free speech, that our freedom of speech will not be intimidated by anybody.
Okay, but
and I'm sure you've heard the crucifix in a jar of urine,
right?
Example, by contrast. I'm sure you've heard of that, where everybody and their brother was saying, you know, it's all free speech, just the art, don't be so high strung about it, you know. So basically her statement is not exactly what they're saying, but she's saying something I think a lot more important to Americans, and that is that we have the right to
express
ourselves the same way about Muhammad, the same way anti-Christians would express themselves against Christianity. There's no difference, and there shouldn't be any difference, don't you think?
Well, again, it gets down to, if I understand right, that hall was owned by the school district, right? And they rent that hall to whoever comes along and wants to rent it, right? But in her case, she was so inflammatory, she actually put the county and the school district at risk by renting that place out. They're lucky they didn't get a whole, you know, that whole place bombed or something by her renting that hall. So, to me, she's not only white trash, but she's putting the public's property at risk. You know, the school districts are having a tough enough time dealing with a budget, but to rent the place out to a jerk who puts the public property at risk, that's where it gets into shouting fire in a crowded theater, especially when there's not a fire. And so the issue again is whether or not, I mean, for example, you go as a religious show, right? You realize that Muhammad was an offshoot of Christianity.
Absolutely.
And Christianity is an offshoot of the Jews,
Judaism,
right?
Right.
And it all has to do with merchants in the temple. So Jesus was railing about merchants in the temple. Muhammad was concerned about merchants in the Christian temple. And so he's dealing with the same God, Yahweh. It's just some language differences. And the fighting between Christians and Muslims and Jews is merchants in the temple who are trying to cash in on it.
I hear you, David, but I think your take is a little bit wishful on their position toward Christians and Jews. But anyway, thanks for calling. We really appreciate your contribution.
And we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be right back after these quick commercial breaks here on Power Talk 1210, Solomon on Blast. Blast here on Power Talk 1210. We appreciate David calling in that discussion. In this next story, Proverbs 14:10 says, the heart knows its bitterness, and a stranger does not share its joy. Well, according to this article by a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Daniel Lapin, I've just kind of found his blog out there, and he has a lot of good thoughts on along the same topics, wisdom and everything. And in this article, he says, it's entitled Into the Valley of Equality. And he talks about how in the world today that it's truly terrifying that more young males are being brought up without a father than ever before. And he says, yes, that is terrifying. And he says, it's because boys need dads to help them acquire self-discipline and become men of honor. Because those with real-life experience of the criminal justice system will tell you that one factor most shared by incarcerated men is not economic status, race, or gang affiliation, but the absence of a father in the home. And he says, thus, more boys without dads, the more frightened we should be. And it's frightened, he says, terrifying also that America is losing influence in the world. And then he gets to the real point of it as, is it truly terrifying that there's more income equality in America than ever before? He says he's trying to find out. He says one thing for sure is that there's more talk of income equality than ever before, but is it really that dangerous of a thing that there is inequality in the world today or in America to the extent that the coverage that it gets in media? Most Americans are reasonably comfortable, and he says that for most people, how people behave is more important than how much money they have. So is equality really that big a deal? Is it that important in the whole scheme of things? Well, when you look at the Bible, there's never anywhere that it really talks about things having to be equal.
Well, one of the greatest examples I've heard of this, and I forgot the gentleman's name. I wish I remembered it, but he's talked about modifying, for example, the word justice. And he says, when you say justice, you understand justice is blind, that it doesn't matter what color you are. If you steal, you steal.
Right.
And you're going to face the consequences of stealing, but you modify the term and you call it social justice, then suddenly all the dynamics of justice change. Now it has to do with where you grew up, you know, how much money your parents earned, what kind of neighborhood you grew up in, et cetera. And now that just completely changes the definition. And equality is one of those words, I think, that changes the definition of morality, as Daniel Lapin is pointing out. It changes it. It's like morality means right and wrong. But you add the word equality to it, you modify the meanings of right and wrong into being whatever you want them politically to mean to you. And I think he's making a fantastic point.
Yeah, he says maybe equality is just, he asks the question, is equality just plain immoral? He says the trouble is the words moral and immoral are utterly meaningless without specifying the framework that defines morality. And today it's socialism, it's liberalism, it's progressivism that define what is and isn't moral.
I think what makes, it's so meaningful equality is basically that you have equal standing to God, you know, that all human beings have equal worth in the eyes of God. I think that's the truest meaning of equality. But one of the very uncomfortable theological realities that come from that is that then God gives each according to his several ability, to quote the verse, you
right.
know, directly. In other words, God hands out to however he wants to, and that he's the one who ultimately holds in his hand. And it's very important to also understand that God is, as Daniel Lappin points out so tremendously, is that that's not the most important thing, what you have in your hand. So if you're very materialistic and you assume your worth is based on how much you hold in your hand, well, this is going to really bother you.
Right.
Which is really one of the greatest truths here about covetousness, you know, being envious, is that you can be rich or poor and be as equally covetous.
Yeah.
You know,
you can be as
because
greedy.
Your whole value system is based on stuff and not on, you know, the worth of your soul.
Right. And the thing is that what he really is pointing out here is that this level of having to have equality ends up causing much more problem than it does solve things. And especially when you look at the real problems that he's pointing out, which is that there aren't fathers in households, and you've got kids that are running around.
Yeah, that's a much greater problem.
Much, much greater.
And in the long run, it probably affects income inequality as much as any factor out there, in that these kids aren't prepared. They don't have the same opportunities based on the way they've grown up, based on the support they get as children from, a two-parent home. And there's a lot of other factors associated with this, and try to remove inequality as its own issue, I think, is actually just downright intellectually dishonest.
Agreed. And we've got to take a break at the half hour, so we'll come back with probably a little more discussion along these lines. If you want to weigh in, give us a call, 750-7456. We'll be right back. Here on Solomon on Blast on Power Talk 1210. And that song, With Respect, I think that's what really these people are trying to get, is respect by making everybody equal rather than by their actions, their moral behavior. It's, okay, I'm going to get respect by coming through and forcing everybody to be equal.
Well, let's go right to the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law. You know, this idea that society can confer upon you, government can confer upon you your sense of equality. And so this really is a very important discussion to people that believe in God, because again, we believe that God is no respecter of persons.
Absolutely.
And that equality is not conferred and cannot, and because it cannot be conferred by government, can never be taken away by government, because it comes from God. And I think that's the safest place to keep it, don't you?
Absolutely. And that's kind of what Daniel's talking about in this particular article. He actually refers to a story in Genesis where Abraham defeats a king, Nimrod, and it was really what he's referring to in the equality aspect was, there's really only one place in the Bible he says that the word equality comes up, at least in the Old Testament, and that is in reference to this area where the king of the Valley of Equality wanted everybody equal. And what that...
It was the first socialist.
Absolutely. It was basically what he's appealing to here, is that this is what happens. And their promise of equality was to have power over everybody. That was their view of equality. But...
Yeah, perfect equality on earth can only be... The power then must be completely vested in government. in order to begin to affect an equality program in any level, right? Other than that, you have to leave it to God. You know, and he does make the statement. I love this. He said it. Speaking of the Old Testament mention, he said there are 79,976 words in the Torah, and it's only one is the word equality comes, and not in the best context.
Right.
So
and so Abraham was attempting to overthrow this king, and it really comes out that this guy was looking for power over everybody.
So the real issue to me, and I think what's made America the world's greatest country, is that we have, in fact, a very still, it's weakening, but a very strong middle class. And I remember, and I've had the opportunity to travel a little bit and been to Europe a few times over the years, and I know middle class people in Europe work very hard, live in smaller houses than we certainly do in the United States,
right,
and are fortunate. I'm talking about the middle class, the working people with education. They have one family car, and they will have a much smaller flat. You come to the United States, and you see people who have different kinds of skills, two cars,
right,
and a 2,500 square foot home, 2,000 square foot, 2,500 square foot home, and you don't have people that don't have the same level of education. You know, the same, right, the same backgrounds, but because of the economy of the United States, because of the established middle class in the United States, more people get to experience this level of prosperity than anywhere in the world. There's no place in the world that even comes close to comparing to the United States in this respect. So it's really, and what I'm saying, it doesn't matter if a guy, there's rich people in America.
No, because it, as long as it just
you're able to prosper
bigger
and do well, what's the problem?
That's the
why
whole,
would you hate somebody because they have more than you?
That's the whole, the rising tide floats all boats, right? That's really where that aspect of it's coming from. And that greater economy just means there's a bigger pie. So the whole inequality aspect of it is, well, if you want inequality or if you want equality, the pie is probably going to shrink pretty small, and those pieces are going to get even smaller than what you have today.
You can have a bigger piece of a tiny pie, percentage-wise, or you can have a smaller piece of a huge pie that ends up being much bigger than your fairer piece somewhere else, you know? And it's amazing that people don't see such a simple idea, and you have to travel a little bit maybe to get it, but when you start talking about equality and income equality, what you're doing then is you're saying, I can't be happy until I have what that rich guy has.
And that's just covetousness all that is.
It's the worst kind of envy and covetousness.
Right.
And
the Bible,
it doesn't build goodness.
Yeah, the Bible's pretty clear that man was never designed to be his own moral authority. And as hard as that is, humanity just doesn't have the proper equipment to navigate that moral and ethical path. And King Solomon is pretty clear about it. He says in Proverbs 14:12, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end is the ways of death. So what Daniel Lapin's talking about here is pretty clear. We don't have the wherewithal to be able to create that moral authority and decide what is and isn't right and wrong. It's got to come from a higher authority.
The question is, who are you going to trust with the power to make things equal? God or the government? I think it's pretty simple. Who do you trust more? A group of human beings motivated by political ambitions or the one who created heaven and earth? Where do you want to put your trust? Because you will put your trust somewhere. We referred to a statistic a few weeks ago from Nick Gillespie's column, Reason.com,
right,
where he was really trying to make a case that millennials are not as off the wall as you think. But then he said at the very end, that completely reversed my opinion of what he was trying to say, was that 70% of millennials favored guaranteed, what was it, income
housing
and health care.
Yeah.
So how in the world are you going to get those things guaranteed without empowering literally a dictator?
Yeah, and Daniel Lapin ends his article very succinctly. He says, inequality is not scary. He says, you know what is? When politicians start talking of inequality, that is scary. When they promise to eradicate inequality, that's just plain terrifying, because that can be achieved only by obliterating freedom. So there you have it. We'll take a break for these commercials, and we'll be back with more Solomon on Blast. Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. She works hard for the money, but you know what? There's never been a woman on the face of a dollar bill or any denominational bill in the United States. And this article asks, how hard would it be to change the $20 bill? And on paper, it doesn't look like it'd be difficult, according to the article, to change the faces that greet us on the dollar bill whenever we pull out our wallets. But the Treasury Secretary has unilateral authority to banish Franklin from the $100 or Lincoln from the $5 bill whenever he wants. Congress also has the power to change the portraits used on U.S. currency. The possibilities for new monetary muses are nearly limitless. The only requirement is they be dead, just like the luminaries chosen for stamps. So fortunately, that will leave out Hillary from being able to show up on our money in the next couple of years. There's also an expectation that the portraits will be familiar faces from history. However, the process must be harder than it looks, because the Treasury hasn't retired a portrait since 1929, when Andrew Jackson replaced Grover Cleveland, which has everybody wondering what will happen with the new campaign to get a woman on the $20 bill. Plenty of people have tried to change the portrait. Most of these attempts involve Ronald Reagan, 2004. Grover Norquist tried to boot Alexander Hamilton off the 10 and replace him with the conservative icon. Senator Mitch McConnell thought the idea was a great one to have Reagan on there. Hamilton was a nice guy and everything, but he wasn't president, according to Norquist. And a few of the House Republicans were trying to get Reagan on the $20 bill. So what they're really looking to try and do, though, is get a woman on the $20 bill. And there's been a lot of different people that they're pointing to that they want to put on there. But the question is it significant? Are they a significant enough person to put on our currency? What would you think, Fred?
Oh, I don't know. You know, Dolly Madison has already had her name on fruit pies. So, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, where do you go? You go to the Susan B. Anthony coin. Remember that one?
That one didn't go very well, and that was a coin.
They can. I don't know. I think they had to revisit the posthumous standard there. And remember, Hillary is running for president 2016. This might be a pretty good advertising campaign, you know.
Yeah, but she's got to be dead, according to the current law, is that you've got to be dead in order to show up on that.
I know. I mean, that's but you know, that's never stopped the Clintons before, this kind of stuff. They've always got an angle.
They'll find somebody to kill.
Remember
off,
just,
what you're
what was it, just last year CNN and NBC were both like going to do special projects featuring Hillary Clinton's life story. So I wouldn't put it past them to at least try to submit her name in there and get her on there. It's funny. I remembered reading the article about this NBC because of pressure they got from the Republicans decided not to make the miniseries. And it's funny. They got the actress, Diane Lane, you know, a much more attractive woman than Hillary Clinton to play her part. I think once Bill Clinton heard about that, he offered to play himself, you know, in the love scene. Here's
some of the names that they're throwing out there for the women. Margaret Sanger, who helped popularize birth control.
Sure.
They're hesitant to court that controversy in the Treasury.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other women... Betty Friedan, Sojourner Truth, Rachel Carlson, and Rosa Parks, all important, some equally bound to cause political tantrums. So it's hard to find that neutral one.
I think Sojourner Truth is the best one I've heard.
Amelia Earhart
in that group
as the ideal portrait, citing her popularity and apolitical place in memory.
Yeah, what about Sacagawea and Pocahontas, Harriet Tubman?
Yeah. We could, you said Dolly Madison.
I think we ought to go, actually, I think Sacagawea is a good one. I think we ought to go native on this one. Seriously. I mean, if you're going to
you cover multiple minorities.
Yeah. Or Pocahontas. I mean, you go to the Capitol building in Washington, and there's one of the main portraits features Pocahontas.
Oh, yeah.
So she is fundamental to the history of the United States. So maybe I'm switching. I'm going with Pocahontas.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you just got to wonder, though, if they put people that are maybe too recent, that it has a tendency to cause people not to remember who really created this country. And having somebody like Pocahontas would be a good one because it goes back to the real founding of this country. I think people like Rosa Parks or whatever, it's more modern. Sometimes I would say it kind of gives you the... feel that maybe you're dealing with monopoly money instead of real currency when you put too new of a
and it could be way too political as well.
Right.
And that would be polarizing to people.
Right. And then it becomes a monopoly money kind of thing. And so to me, it would have to be somebody from a much longer time period ago than the more current ones. Just because people remember what's going on today doesn't make it significant enough to... be on the dollar bills.
Yeah, well, the more we talk about it, the more I'm going with Pocahontas. I'm behind that. I'll sign the petition, Oscar. Just produce it. I think that's the best one.
Oscar says Beyonce, but no, unless she died overnight.
Well, then there's maybe not Beyonce, but Sasha Fierce might be somebody I would consider.
Okay.
Wasn't Lady Liberty somebody that was on there? I know it's not a real person, but...
No, it's not
Statue of Liberty.
Right, Statue of Liberty is not a lot of things. But
or Lady Freedom, one of the two. I don't remember. One was on the silver certificate.
The silver dollar had Lady Freedom on it with the flag and everything. So, but it seems to be a big controversy in trying to get the
I think it's, again, you know, I guess my phrase is I think it's a fair discussion. I think it's time to talk about it. I think it's something that they really should consider. But I don't think they should. I think they need to be very careful not to just make it the latest political trend. And that's where these things become a joke and people will lose respect for the whole concept and the whole process of it. Good luck. Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck there. Maybe it's... who's singing this one? Donna Summers. Maybe that's who we need. All right, we'll be back right after these commercial breaks. More Solomon on Blast.
That's all right, Mama, just any way you do, that's all right. all right. That's all right, Mama. Anyway, do. Well, Mama, she done told me. Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you fooling with, she ain't no good to you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right.
All right, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Interesting article that showed up about a week ago regarding a nun from Iraq. She says, Sister Diana wants to tell Americans about ISIS persecution of Christians in Iraq, but the State Department won't let her in. And basically, this article had gotten coverage, like I said, about a week ago. Sister Diana Momeka of the Dominican Sisters of St. Catherine of Siena was informed about a week ago by the U.S. consulate that her non-immigrant visa application had been rejected. The reason given in the denial letter, a copy of which is in this article, says you were not able to demonstrate your intended activities in the United States would be consistent with the classification of the visa, but it seems that there were two other people that were also invited to this particular, come speak in Congress that were given the right to come into the country. And she said that in Iraq itself, the consular officer told her she was denied because she was an internally displaced person, and the State Department was effectively calling her a deceiver. She was going to visit for 1 week. She had meetings set up with the Senate and House Foreign Relations Committee, State Department, USAID, and other organizations in support of her application. She had multiple documents vouching for her and the temporary nature of her visit. She submitted a letter from her prioress, the head nun there, if attested that the nun has been gainfully employed, and so on and so forth. And she also submitted an invitation from her sponsors, two highly respected Washington area institutes. But the State Department wasn't buying it. It either thought they were all in on the scheme or that she was plotting to deceive her well-placed friends. Basically, they didn't want her to stay in the country is what it was.
Well, they point out here, and I think this is a good line in this National Review article, the U.S. seems determined to deny ISIS Christian victims that's the status of a refugee. They seem determined. The narrative of the State Department under the Obama administration is to continue to say that Christians are not all that victimized in these countries.
And they don't want the voices heard, and they think they're going to come to the United States and not go back.
The policy is you guys are not being as persecuted as you claim you are. That's the policy. And even though everything else says otherwise, the Obama administration wants to continue to hold their line and their narrative. And very sadly, this nun is not useful to their narrative, so they don't want her to come in.
Now, the good part about all this, though, is that Newsmax picked up the story, and J.D. Haworth had picked it up. And they were able to generate enough opposition to the State Department's ruling that people called in, and Newsweek believes that through their publishing this and pushing the story pretty hard out there, that the State Department did turn around their ruling this week. Okay. And so now she's going to be allowed to come into the United States. But it took a significant amount of pressure from the listeners, viewers of Newsmax, in order to get this nun to allow her to come speak to Congress and these groups here in the United States. So in the end, it actually worked out pretty well, but it kind of gives you an idea of, like you said, what's really going on behind the State Department. And it's sad that it took that much effort just to get her.
Well, at least they didn't make her post the Facebook picture with her rosary and a jar of urine to finally make them think she was down with it.
Right.
She was cool enough to come into America. So, you know, it's this is all politics, and it makes you kind of sad that in reality you think that these things are being filtered out carefully and fairly, and then you realize it's so hyper-political. It makes you not even want to think about it anymore, Doug.
Yeah.
I mean, which is not the proper reaction. But you know what I mean? It makes you want to say, who even cares anymore? Because everyone's pretending. And they're just right. politically motivated, which is very cynical, which we can't allow that thought to stay very long.
A quick one greater than Solomon story here for in honor of Mother's Day. This particular mother, her name was Monica, a Christian. She was married to a prominent man who wasn't a believer. He was unfaithful, beat her at times. Her response was to go to church every day and pray for his conversion. She hoped that by setting a godly example, even in the midst of her mistreatment, she might win him over, and that's exactly what happened. The suffering and anguish caused by her husband, though, paled before what her oldest son put her through. He lived a dissolute life, devoted to pleasure. He left one mistress, took up another. His only son was born out of wedlock. His lack of faith and rejection of Christian truth hurt her even more. He belittled her faith and seemed to go out of his way to embrace Christianity's competitors for the hearts and especially the minds of his contemporaries. He later recalled how his being dead to the faith and spirit, which, as he put it, my mother had from the Lord, made her weep. Still, Monica never gave up. The greatest preacher of the time, knowing of her prayers and tears for her son, told her it's impossible that the son of so many tears should perish. And that preacher was Bishop Ambrose of Milan. He was right. At the age of 35, Monica's son, Augustine, who we now know as Saint Augustine, became a Christian and was baptized along with his son. A few months later, on the way home with Augustine, his mother fell ill and died. But she couldn't have known that her prayers and devotion would affect not only the life of her son, but also the course of history. Her concern was that her son believe the truth which is in Jesus. This devotion to the spiritual welfare of her son is why Monica is regarded as the model for all Christian mothers. She had a zeal for the salvation of her son and had an impact beyond anything she could have imagined. So, that's it for Solomon on Blast this week. For all the mothers out there, have a great Mother's Day. And until next week, think wisely. Son, that gal you fooling wish she ain't all good to you, but that's all right. That's all right. That's all right.